I want to begin by reading this thing that Ann, this is only slightly related. It's something that Ann Kohlberg read, I think it was a week or 2 weeks ago for Matins, and I thought it was kind of catchy. I liked it. So we'll read it here. There once was a man who could be counted upon to go down the aisle at revival meetings in order to recommit his life to Christ. Each time he'd get down on his knees at the altar and yell, "Fill me, Jesus, fill me, Jesus." He'd get all psyched up with religion, and 3 weeks later he'd lose his excitement and be right back in the same old worldly ways. Every time a new evangelist hit town and held meetings, the man would go through the same routine. He'd go down the aisle, get down on his knees at the altar, and shout over and over again, "Fill me, Jesus." People became cynical about his commitments at the altar. And one time when he was doing this thing and yelling, "Fill me, Jesus, fill me, Jesus," some lady at the back of the church shouted, "Don't do it, Lord, he leaks." That's one of the great problems of the Christian life, isn't it? We leak. All of us have had some super-duper spiritual experience in which we felt close to God, but soon found out that it didn't last. All of us feel like we leak. We seem to lose our zeal and excitement, and all of us fail to carry out faithfully the commitments we made to do the will of God. Well then, what's the answer? How does a person keep from leaking? The bad news is that we can't stop the leaking. The good news is that each of us can be refilled regularly. Being regularly refilled is what Jesus wants for us and for everyone. Well, that's called leaky living. I would sort of extrapolate from that and say that we're talking about world views, what is the world we live in, the conceptual world that we formulate visions with and define our ministry by and make decisions and value judgments. There's the world revealed in Scripture, the world of God, which in God's terms makes sense. And then there's the world that we're much more acquainted with, the surrounding culture. The people of God have been surrounded by Pharaoh's culture, and they've been surrounded by the Canaanite culture, and they've been surrounded by the Babylonian culture, and they've been surrounded by the Roman culture. And now you can name any country in the world and still say, you know, the people of God in that country are surrounded by that culture. And when we really buy into, or sell out to, whichever way you want to word it, that surrounding culture, you know, we're pretty leaky. We don't hold much of God's Spirit at that point. We're participating and living in a different world. And the renewal of our covenant relationship with God, which Martin Luther called the daily renewal of our baptism, is being refilled, renewed in the kingdom of God, and living in that kingdom, in that world view. And that world view tends to be very abrasive. Stands in contrast to this worldview, and when they seem to be cozy bed partners, the chances are that really the biblical worldview has been domesticated and watered down and diluted. Because I think at the base of it, they're incompatible with each other. They don't make cozy bed partners. Well, first question, so that it gives me some idea of, well, what we will talk about is how many people, now, don't mean to embarrass anybody, just to set a stage here. How many people have read chapters 8, 9, and 10 out of the Bible Makes Sense? Okay, so Florence has, Connie has. Well, since some of you have, let me begin by saying, is there something in there, a sentence, a statement, a paragraph, or one of the questions at the end of the chapter that that you want to make comment about, raise question, challenge, or you want everybody to hear it and you read it and say, that's a good statement. It balances out with, on page 9, you can keep a finger by 149, but on page 9, the first page of the book, the first text page, the statement that it is strange the Bible is our most treasured book, and yet it seems so difficult, should be a comma, that we don't find it very helpful. That's the situation. He says, perhaps we have expected the wrong things of it. We have asked of it, the Bible, what it cannot do. We have expected the Bible to keep promises it has never made to us. The Bible cannot be a good luck piece to bring God's blessings, nor can it be an answer book to solve our problems or to give us right belief. So the first question about reading the Bible is, what can indeed we expect of it? Now, if this perspective on page 149 is correct, that the Bible is to be discerned as much as a set of questions posed to the church as a set of answers, what are some of the questions that are posed to the church by the Bible? The question is, what is the relation of church and state? What other question, or do you want to make a comment on that one? Sometimes that's a whole bag of.
On that one, I think that our nation is more richly blessed than most nations because we recognize God in our monetary system. I don't know any other nation in the world that has "In God We Trust" on it. Okay. And I have fear that sometimes somebody is going to, like, prayer in the school is going to say, "We can't have that. Let's remove it." One joker will do that, and the whole nation will fall, like we do what did with the prayer.
Response, or you were going to say?
I just had another question: what does the Bible ask? Well,
what other question does it ask?
Who do you say that I am?
What might be some other questions? Yeah. I kind of wonder, whose book is it? Open-ended sort of thing. Whose book is the Bible? Well, maybe another question, a question for the Bible, let's say, that gets at the Bible's question for us. What would you say is a central theme or a central teaching of the Bible? And then for whom is that a teaching?
One fellow, I don't know his name, but it's a magazine back there. We're reading the whole back page, and he had been somewhere for a period of maybe 2 weeks, took a stack of books, and ended up, for whatever reason, reading only the Bible, read from beginning clear through to the end, just continuously.
Yeah.
And he'd read it many, many times before, but not in that same way.
Oh.
And he said the thing that jumped out at him was God's love, even when he was reading about wars and tragedies and all that.
Yeah.
It just kept coming. That was the thing to him.
Yeah. How's that love expressed, and to whom is it expressed? And who responds to it?
Me.
Everybody, pro or con.
Yeah.
Well, yesterday, we were talking about the people who were considered outcasts.
Yeah.
And they were considered good as dead as far as what they were to society.
Who accepted and responded to Jesus' teaching?
The people who had nothing to lose.
Yeah. It is kind of a potpourri here. Why did Jesus get killed? Did Jesus get killed for being a nice guy? He didn't throw any rocks. He didn't shoot any bullets.
He stirred up things.
Wasn't he a nice guy? He went around healing people.
Sometimes he said he wouldn't.
He went around feeding folks and raising them from the dead. Why did he get killed?
It was the only way that God could accept humanity and forgive humanity's sins.
Well,
I don't know. I mean, that's a very dry, short statement.
Yeah.
I think it was in God's plan. It had to be that way.
It was in God's plan, but, you know, did God make the people kill Jesus then who killed Jesus? You know, were they like puppets on a string?
Their ways of doing that.
Yeah, really what Jesus did was terribly abrasive and radical and unacceptable to the establishment.
To the Jewish religion.
To the establishment, whatever establishment it is. Well, is that true only in the Bible?
Today?
Yeah, what would be an illustration today? Yeah. Ordination of women in the Roman Church, tremendous threat to the establishment.
Well, even not too many years ago, tremendous threat to the public schools to have women become administrators.
Yeah. Establishments are conservative. That is, they're self-protecting. Conserve their invested interests, and things that disrupt them are very threatening. I spend a lot of time in school. You know, I have a lot invested in the educational system. I've got a lot invested in my own library. and I don't jump up and down with glee automatically when I think of what's called base Christian communities in Central America. You know, this is grassroots koinonia type thing. You know, it's populated by have-nots. And they are, and some of the people are able to articulate what they're doing, and they write some books, you know, and they enter into some teaching that is amongst themselves. And the first question that comes to my mind is, well, who trained them? Where did they go to seminary? You know, what kind of theological pedigree do they have? Who said they're theologians? You know, the system of going to school and being credentialed and reading all the right books, why, that's the way it's supposed to be, of course, isn't it? And now there are communities who are claiming that their experience is parallel to those who were slaves in Pharaoh's brickyards. And they're saying that the theme of the Bible isn't just save us from our sin, because that save us from our sin means obey the rules, and obey the rules is kind of is the security of the establishment. They're saying the theme of the Bible is liberation. What God did was to free people in bondage, to free oppressed, to bring back to life, borrowing yesterday's themes, to bring back to life and bring back to community those who are outcasts and regarded by the establishment as nobodies, as unclean, as outsiders. Well, it just, you know, all kinds of stuff in there that's upsetting to all my theological indoctrination.
Not only that, Todd, but you know that there are diploma factories, and you can just send away for a diploma and get a doctorate. And unless there are so many institutions who give doctorates that it states it's a university from some place or other, and unless they have some way of looking it up.
Yeah.
You can have medical doctors, you can have doctorates in education or any profession.
Yeah, we not only can,
we
do.
And they just go ahead and they've got that.
Yeah.
They probably could even just go ahead and have the birth certificate changed and call themselves a doctor.
But what these people are practicing isn't a matter of claiming to be, you know, to have had all the education. They're saying all the that education is, in many ways, self-serving. And really doesn't do the ministry that's biblical ministry. There aren't any oppressed people without oppressors. There aren't any abused people without abusers. And so their claim is that in many ways the establishment, the institution, and that's somewhat impressionistic because it applies here and there. And the institution contributes to that. I don't know if you're waving to me or the baby or...
No, if you... I was going to say, Bob, I wish I would have brought manuscripts of my book, Challenging Confronted, which critiques liberation theology, amongst other things. But I feel that those who support liberation theology have failed to read George Orwell's 1984. And the point of that is, you know, until Christ comes to, gather his church, we're always going to live in oppressive societies. It's a relative statement because...
In a what society?
Oppressive.
Oppressive.
Because the lesson from Orwell's, did I say 1984? I meant Animal Farm, is that even if the oppressed overthrew the oppressor, they in turn would be the oppressor, because that's just human nature.
And that is the story of God's people.
In what way?
That they were the oppressed, and then they become the well-off and take advantage of others. And Solomon's system of enforced labor and taxation was itself as oppressive. In fact, you get to the end of Solomon's reign, and you read the text, and it for all intents and purposes says that what Pharaoh did was, or what Solomon did was to lead the people back to Egypt. I don't mean geographically, but the freed people of God were enslaved by the monarchy. And the north revolted, and so Solomon was the end of the monarchy, and from then on it's a divided kingdom. And so it just keeps going, the same pattern, but it's always that the ones for whom God intercedes and takes action are the ones who are on the bottom. The ministry of Jesus is that way. The slaves in Egypt, the exiles in Babylon. Read the book of Acts, and there's that same kind of fluctuation that people get involved, and then they goof things up, and it falls apart, and the Spirit intercedes and restores and reconciles and gets it headed in the right direction again. And then people try to use the gifts of the Spirit for their own end, and then it falls apart. And the same kind of pattern keeps going. And the people who would say, well, let's just leave it the way it is, are always the better off people. So the ones who I think would dismiss liberation theology are not the ones who need to be liberated. They're the ones who are trying to consolidate their power and to preserve their power, but it's at the expense of other people.
The problem with the teachings of Gustavo Gutierrez and Miranda and those of that camp claim that it's the poor that, you know, God is going to reach out to solely, without failing to realize that all humankind is sin. The poor are just as much to blame for their problems as are the rich, because we do live in a sinful world. And to say that, like I've read Gutierrez's books on, you know, liberation theology.
Liberation
and
of
I
theology.
I think his theology is horrible, put it that way, yeah. Because his presupposition
but it's not
is
a
that
question
salvation
for me is
on this
is it horrible? Is it biblical?
No, I don't.
And that's what this book is saying. What sense of the world does the Bible make? The Bible construes God's history with God's people in what way? And at that point, it's not a matter of evaluating theology on theological grounds or philosophical grounds or Orwell's books, but it's it's a matter of evaluating on what is the history of God's involvement in history with God's people. Whom does God intercede? And it's the oppressed, the widow, the stranger, the sojourner, the fatherless, the slave, the orphan. You know, continually God is active in history and teaching about how we should order our lives on behalf of, in the interest of, and serving those people. And I think that calls into question a lot of our ministry.
And most people's prayers, oddly enough, are that, God, give me strength so that I may get to the top of that totem pole.
Yeah.
Weird.
But in the thing that I don't tend to look at, I haven't, and I suspect there are a lot of people like me, is that getting to the top of that totem pole is accomplished by standing on top of somebody else.
Mm-hmm. That's why, and God's supposed to be for the little people.
Yeah.
While
I stand on them, I'll pray for them. It just, last couple of weeks, I had a new thought about an ongoing project. I have some interest in the lament psalms. I talked some about the structure of lament psalms in this class earlier in the week. Over half of the psalms in the book of Psalms are laments. There are other laments also in Scripture, but over half of them just in that one book are laments. And I've noticed that although a lot of psalms, for example, are in the LBW or in the United Methodist hymnal or the United Church of Christ hymnal and others, the ones that tend to, not all the psalms are in those hymnals. And the psalms that tend to be the ones not included are lament psalms, especially some of them that are rather strong language. You know, God, I want you to rip open pregnant women and bash children's heads against the wall, and we don't put those in the hymnal. They don't sound Christian enough. Well, over half the psalms are lament psalms. And I kind of ask the question, well, whose psalms are those? Who laments? And the thought I've had recently is that the people who lament are the people who are in pain and in grief, who live in an asymmetrical world, for whom things are not going smoothly. Sociologically, those are the marginal people, the homeless people, the unemployed people, the dislocated people. And then when I look at the hymnals that tend not to include laments, then I can say, well, who's in the church? And apparently those are the well-off people and the comfortable people and the people for whom things go well, etc. And then I kind of ask the question, I wonder about, you touched on this all in stronger language than I would use. You know, who's God's people? Or who are the people for whom God would be actively at work, yearning for and seeking out? And are they the people who tend to be in the church, or the people who tend not to be in the church? Interesting, last Sunday's lesson in Luke chapter 7 about the centurion who comes to Jesus because his slave is sick and at the point of death. And by the end of the account, the slave is well again. We don't know anything about the slave. Didn't say the slave believed in Jesus. Didn't say the slave was a Christian or a Jew, even a law-abiding, Torah-obeying. didn't say even if the slave believed in God. The centurion sought out Jesus, and the slave was healed. Well, I just, you know, hadn't really sat there and thought about it. The one who got the benefits, so to speak, of God's activity, the slave, wasn't even on the scene. But God's healing, caring relationship with this world includes uncredentialed slaves. The people who lament, even if they don't use the lament songs.
That was the path that got the prophet rather than the husband.
Well, the slave got health.
Indirectly, the slave got it.
You know, there's just a lot that's not said in the account. But what is said is very teasing thoughts of what are some of the questions in that scripture.
It would remind me of people who need somebody like the centurion to help them if they're, say, in a mental institution or a nursing home, where the care is horrendous or, you know, not adequate and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And may not be their own doing that got them there. That's beside the point in the way, but somebody needs to be an advocate and improve those situations for the helpless one, for the handicapped one.
Yes, active intercessory prayer on the part of the four who carried the paralytic to the house where Jesus was and couldn't get in through the door, so they took the tiles off the roof. And again, the text says, because of their faith, that the paralytic was made well. So it's the intercessory activity and the faith relationship of others who in both of those texts brings healing to marginal, unable-bodied, uncredentialed, as good as dead people. Well, that's not really how I order my world. You know, I do things for people who can pay me back favors, you know. I'll scratch your back and you scratch my back. If we're going to spend time together, I want to know what school you were trained at. You know, are we the same pedigree? And I like to associate with people who think the way I think. Jesus didn't seem to do that. Yeah, that's right. It's more comfortable. And then if somebody comes along and disrupts our comfortable world, why... One thing we can do is get them crucified.
This way, mingling with your own, in a sense, you are stabbing your own ego.
Yeah.
And you're preventing yourself from being attacked so that you lose your position in your peer group. And I'm not saying you, I'm saying all of us in a discipline. But on page 154 it says that the Bible is a lens through which all of life is being discerned. No experience is seen in a vacuum but always through some set of experiences and some set of presumptions. It's really important that we become more knowing about various lenses which reflect interest in ideologies and decisively shape what we see. And that's probably what we have to do with the Bible. And, that's what we're doing. I mean, the Bible stories, we're using those Bible stories as lenses to project into today's world as well and into our own minds.
Yeah, knowing the... become more aware of the difference, the various lenses that we use, but lenses which reflect interests and ideologies that decisively shape what we see. It's kind of like
asking the question, and whose world do we live in? You know, what's the world we see? What lens? Who provides the lens? So you could say, is it a biblical lens? Is it the lens of Jung and Freud? Is it the lens of capitalism? Is it the lens of Marx-Leninist philosophy? Is it the lens of whom? And knowing that none of us ever sees the world except that we see it through some lens. Excuse me, Florence. What you, she was.
Graham was telling about a narrow interpretation, and even sadder consequence of someone who was not very knowledgeable and had read the Bible by himself. You know, wasn't with the church or anywhere, but just on their own read the Bible and took it word for word. And this person read this part that if he was questioned by the court, he would say yay, yay or nay, nay. And that's all he would say when he was brought to court. And he wasn't guilty. Somebody else was, but he wouldn't speak up. And I can't imagine, but the outcome was that he was punished because he wouldn't testify.
Yeah.
It is a horrendous thing. I can't imagine the judge in a case like that being that narrow or whatever it's called. Whoever had done the crime got biased, got free, and he paid it because he wouldn't go by the court rule.
Because he was doing what he thought was a literal rendering of the text.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So they certainly should have been able to see through that.
Yeah. Vi, you were saying what?
We were talking about Freud. I don't know that. And Connie said Freud was a Jew, and I remember that Freud was a Jew, but I don't know that in any of his works that he had any religious introspection.
Oh, when I said Freud, and when I talk about Freud's lens, I just mean psychoanalysis and Freud's definition of what makes a person human, you know, and what controls a person and what motivates a person, so that our a person is defined as the interrelationship of superego, ego, and id, and what vitalizes that. And so that's Freud's definition of what it means to be human, and what life is about. Now you can take Plato's definition, or Aristotle, or St. Thomas Aquinas, or, you know, you just go on down through philosophical, theological systems.
I had a momentary fleeting thought that if a lot of these psychologists,
by Freud and such,
had more of a Christian input, they could have had a better impact than what they've done.
Well, I don't know if they'd had a better impact or not.
Every time I read Freud, I get upset.
Yeah. I don't know if they'd had a better impact.
I don't know where they came from.
You know, for example, the fact that religious book publishers and religious books are not included in, for example, the New York Times list of the top-selling books, may have somebody who is religious, even Christian, and they may write something very worthwhile, but it doesn't have much impact because it doesn't really get credentialed in the publication world. Religious publishers don't count, just by definition of the establishment who puts together the best-selling books of the week list. They, by definition, they don't include religious publications.
Yeah, they just want to make money on it.
Yeah. So, whether or not these other people would have had more effect or impact, I don't know.
I just thought they could have done a better job.
Yeah, well, we can say, I would like that they had been Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh, Any other thing in chapters 8, 9, and 10 that you want to call attention to, highlight, or use as, or some biblical passage you want to say, well, now, what would Brueggemann do with this text, for example? Or, not that I know. I like to keep it anchored to the text that we're reading, or the biblical text.
I'm sorry, I did it.
No, that's all right. We, you know, we just go like this too. We get closer and further from the text as the discussion goes on. And we get too far afield when
we
come back.
We were talking about the focusing, and so we were focusing on different.
Yeah.
Dimensions.
Yeah.
But that on page 164 also, just rather he or she who has had a changed conscience because of the Bible's central affirmation of the intersection of sovereignty and graciousness. And I think that's a good summation.
Well, it is another example of much of what's talked about in the book.
I thought it was very perfect.
We tend to think of sovereignty and power in terms of power, and God's graciousness is revealed in
the
emptiness, vulnerability, solidarity with the outsider. So that the intersection then of sovereignty and graciousness is not where we would have thought it was, namely in the courts of power and prestige, but it's where power is not there in terms of might and force.
I thought that when I read this, that our direction was that we should have love and kindness and all the good things take over rather than the song of those who are rulers who ruled over us, and that's where I put the sovereignty. It's like we said, little people should be.
Yeah.
The last shall be first and the first shall be last.
Yeah, that again illustrates the a biblical inversion of how we think it is or should be and how in God's world it is. Or that passage in Romans, be not conformed to this world, you know, the cultures of this world and the ordering of this world as we think it is, but be transformed by the renewal of our heart. Be transformed as the Bible makes sense, as God orders the world. Well, Romans 12:2, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. What did I say?
Heart.
Well, different organs, same thing. Yeah. Heart is an organ of commitment. The mind and the mind's eye is an organ of envisioning. Either way, it's to what is our allegiance and how do we live according to it.
Yeah,
so they were like halfway transition.
Kind of thing, yeah.
In so many congregations, we our ministry is defined by cultural standards. In this case, the financial rule.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very anti Wall Street. Decisions, the norm for making a decision, the criteria is what's good for somebody's portfolio and what the impact is on lives and communities is of absolutely no consideration. It's strictly you know, finances. What's good for the portfolio? What's good for the investor? So a community I was in Pennsylvania, building railroad cars that hauled grain, hopper cars, had of several plants that made railroad cars, had the best safety record, best production record. They even built another line, another track, assembly line in the plant because they were doing so well. They just put in this third track assembly line, and a few months later, well, that company, its parent company, was sold to another company in Chicago, and then that whole conglomerate was sold to another place, and they shut down the plant because it was good for tax write-off purposes. And the fact that we had over 25% unemployment didn't count at all. What really counted was a capitalistic Wall Street, what looked good in the portfolio stuff. Human lives didn't amount to anything. A lot of times in our congregations, congregation meetings always have a dialogue between the visionaries and the practicalists. And it's good we have both groups. Yeah. But I tend to slide over with the visionaries, so I hate to see the people who are financially terribly practical always have the upper hand. Well, if there aren't any other comments, I thank you. If you haven't had a chance to look the book over yet, I encourage you to do so. I think it articulates its position better than I do. If I could say it as well as Brueggemann says, well, I'd be pretty satisfied. Encourage you to look at some of his other writings. I mentioned he has a commentary on Genesis, and some people who are in the Search Bible Study program may not have gotten to Genesis yet or be in the midst of it. Encourage you to look that up as a resource for that study. Other than that, thank you.
Thank you.